Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So day one of the WTA finals is done and dusted, and it has been pretty eventful. It's been fascinating to watch the first of the editions in Shenzhen. 10 years it's going to be there. Matt Roberts and myself are here to review it. We've also got an interview with Andrew Bettles, the coach of Alina Svitolina, to look ahead to tomorrow and generally just find out about the life of a travelling coach, because we've not had too many opportunities to talk to people on that score. We've also got matches going on all day long, and Matt and I have been trying to work out when do we record the tennis podcast today, because we've got Federer against Dimonor in the final of Basel at the moment. We've got the Vienna final going on at the moment between Dominic Thiem and Diego Schwartzman, but we've got podcasts coming out of our ears. We're going to be back tomorrow, Catherine and I, so we'll do the full review of the men tomorrow, as well as the second day of the women's matches at the WTA finals. But Matt, let's start with Shenzhen, because we were up bright and early to watch the coverage today, and on TV it looked, I thought, really good. We had first match of the day, Petra Kvitova against Naomi Osaka, then Ash Barty against Belinda Bencic, both three setters. What did you think of the actual staging of the event? It's the first time we've seen it. New sort of colours, new court, new feel.
I thought it looked really good. Basically, I want to be able to see the ball when I watch a tennis match. And I thought the colour scheme that they have, the sort of purple court on a kind of grey background, worked really well. I thought it was quite easy on the eye and you could see the ball really easily. There was a pretty good crowd in, making a decent noise. I think you were saying that the capacity is limited to about 6,500 at the moment, and they are expecting their biggest crowds at the weekend, so it'll be interesting to monitor that throughout the week if it does drop. But for a first day, I thought it was a really good staging of the event, and the tennis was a kind of good illustration of what the women's game is all about at the moment, in that you had so many different kind of styles on offer. The first match was very much two power baseline players up against each other, whereas the second was more about variety and angles and all sorts of tricks that Barty and Bencic can produce.
Yeah, and I think the key to the atmosphere, I mean, as you say, 6,500 doesn't sound that many. Of course, it doesn't compared to some of the stadia that we see around the tennis world, but I would much rather that than a cavernous stadium with a handful of people in it that feels empty. This actually felt full. It felt noisy, and particularly for the Osaka match, which was up first, there was a real appetite for that. I mean, obviously, that was a little earlier in the day as well, so I think, you know, people can make that time of day probably, as particularly at a weekend. And as you say, it'll be fascinating to see over the course of the week, the weekdays particularly, what the atmosphere is like. Let's just have a little look at those matches one at a time, first of all, because Kvitova came out of the blocks so explosively, didn't she? She was leading 2-love. She was break points up in the third game. And I was marvelling at that particular point at the end of the first set, because Osaka won this match in three sets ultimately, but she won that first set despite being down a break and nearly two breaks. And I was really impressed at that stage with her mental calm and dealing with the ups and downs of the Kvitova game. But that didn't last the whole match. We had so many different ups and downs that it was actually, I don't think it was the highest quality match. It wasn't like their Australian Open final, but it was just intriguing. There was loads going on there.
Yeah, in terms of the scoreline, it was kind of eerily similar to their Australian Open final, but the quality wasn't quite there as it had been in Melbourne, which I still think was one of the best matches of the year, that Australian Open final, in terms of quality. And at the start of this one, I was finding it really difficult to tell how well Osaka was playing, simply because she wasn't being allowed to play, because Kvitova was just striking the ball so well, and she must be one of the cleanest strikers of a tennis ball ever when she's on. And she was just, you know, that easy power, winners flying. But then Osaka got a foothold in the match with a hold from double break point down at 2-love, and then Kvitova's level kind of gradually fell off. There's very little light and shade in Kvitova's game. She's kind of either on or she's off, and it was very much like that throughout the match. She had these brilliant games, but then she also had these terrible ones, particularly the first set tiebreak, where she just made just a string of unforced errors, and Osaka managed to win the first set. I also thought Kvitova's serve was a bit of a liability. I think Osaka had spoken before the match saying, "I'm expecting it to be really difficult facing Kvitova's serve, particularly because it's that sort of lefty slice." But Osaka was returning so well on the backhand. I think Kvitova was maybe changing her angles a bit, and she threw in so many double faults. And yeah, as you said, the match kind of got really interesting from a sort of psychological perspective at the end of the second set, start of the third set, where we had a coaching timeout with Osaka's dad. So Osaka was just about to lose the second set, and her dad came on and said, you need to stay calm. You play your best when you stay calm." And Osaka said, "Well, it takes so much to stay calm. It's tiring, and I'm not a naturally calm person," which was such a fascinating sort of visceral insight into Osaka. I almost feel a bit like they're a bit intrusive sometimes, those coaching timeouts, because they do reveal so much, especially when they're in English and we can understand them. A wider point here is we didn't actually get to hear that much from a Kvitova perspective in terms of English-speaking audience. I do find it weird that the WTA hasn't invested in translators for the broadcasters, given that they've been trialing this coaching thing for what seems like, well, it's about 10 years now, I think, isn't it? And sort of the biggest way to justify it is the sort of entertainment that it provides. Well, if a large portion of the audience can't understand it, where is the entertainment? But that's a separate point. But I just think it was fascinating, Osaka, because a lot of the pundits were responding to Osaka's comments in that coaching timeout and almost seeing it as a bit of a sign of weakness, as though she was admitting that she was kind of tired mentally. But really, I felt that was slightly missing the point, because the very fact that Osaka was willing to open up to talk about her emotions is a sign of strength. And it's one of the hardest things to do, talk about how you're feeling. And Osaka is so good at that, so honest with us. And it almost acts as a bit of a release. We've spoken about how her press conferences, she uses them as almost catharsis. Well, I think she used this timeout in that same way.
Yeah, and actually, she went along then and won the third set. It's not like it had a detrimental effect on her at all. And I think the other slight confusion from some quarters was whether she was talking about being tired physically, and that's not what she was saying. And it's not about being burnt out from exertion over the course of the year or anything like that. It was the moment that she was finding tough. She was saying that I'm having to battle my innate tendencies, and by trying to stay calm, I'm having to effectively rewire myself on the spot, and that is really hard work and tiring for me. That's essentially what she was saying, which I think a lot of people can relate to, really, in everyday life. Is, you know, it's all well and good sort of knowing that the best thing you can do is not panic or not get too upset, or which is the word her dad was using, but it's another thing to actually go out and do it yourself, and it's really difficult to do it. The other thing is, I did wonder, watching that Uncut coaching session, is I'm not sure she would have said it in quite that way to anybody other than her dad, because she came across like a child in that moment, and I don't mean that as a criticism. It's just an observation I can imagine that kind of parent-child conversation happening in all walks of life, you know, where it's just too hard. This is just, I don't want to, this isn't me, or I don't want to do this, or whatever. And the parent is, because his follow-up was, look, all I'm saying is you've done it before, and that's when you play your best tennis. You know, everything he was saying was totally rational. And once she'd sort of got it out of her system, she then went and actually did it.
Yeah, and in the same way that Osaka was very much the daughter in that coaching timeout, he was very much the father rather than just the coach. You know, he was saying things like, you're at your best when you're calm, and you can almost imagine him, he's maybe even not thinking about tennis moments where he's seen Osaka be calm before. He's talking about growing up and experiences they've had together as a father and daughter. And yeah, it was a really lovely moment, and it was kind of continued on from there. Really positive, nice coaching exchanges that we saw in Beijing as well. And a lot of talk this year about Osaka's coaching situation and the impact that leaving Sasha Bajin may or may not have had. But certainly at the moment, she seems to be in a really good place with her father coming onto court just occasionally. And this is now the 11th match in a row that she's won since the US Open.
Wow, it's a great stat. Talking of good stats, I just saw your stat about Ash Barty having sealed the year-end number one ranking, which is quite a line, isn't it? She's beaten Belinda Bencic from a set down. It was a very, very tight first set. Then Bencic, I think towards the end of that first set or in the second set, had an injury timeout and had her heel strapped or a foot strapped, and then it was a very different match. Now I suspect it was probably partly Bencic's level dropping, I would have thought something to do with that foot. Now I haven't read the press conference transcript from her yet. I don't think she's been in yet, but I did hear Barty after the match, and she seemed very satisfied and level about her form today. There was no panic there, was there? Because I did think when she lost that first set, that must be a tough one to stomach when it's that close. But she turned it around pretty dramatically.
Yeah, she didn't play a great first set. I think it was 20 unforced errors in that first set and then just 9 for the rest of the match. So she really cleaned her game up, Ash Barty. Yeah, difficult to say exactly how much Bencic's left sort of heel injury or foot injury was the reason for that, because it was already starting to go Barty's way a little bit more that second set. And yeah, so Ash Barty, the first Australian woman to finish the year ranked world number one. She's also youngest to finish world number one since Azarenka about 7 years ago, I think. And yeah, to think that this is her first WTA finals, even as a singles player, and she's come into it as the world number one, and she'll finish it as the world number one. And yet, kind of feels normal based on the year she's had. It just shows how quickly we adjust to these things. But yeah, she's managed to be both consistent this year and also have big wins, which I think has really elevated her. She always had a nice game. She was always good to watch, but she's really become just someone that you trust to win big matches now.
Yeah. She does look the real deal as the world number one, and it's great to see. And it's great to see actually the whole group, really, this divide of new players on the block and established players that have been around for a while and have kept on reproducing, one of which is kind of caught between the two stalls, I feel, is Elina Svitolina, because she's been qualifying for these tournaments for a long time now. and yet she's still a young woman. And her coach these days, and has been for the last couple of years, is Andrew Bettles, a British guy who I've seen around the tour a few times and had one or two conversations with him, and was delighted when we got chance to speak to him very early this morning. I got my timings ever so slightly wrong because I didn't know that the clocks had gone back when I woke up this morning, and I set my alarm to an hour ahead of time because we were 7 hours behind here in the UK, and I thought, oh, I'll give myself a good hour to get set up before talking to Andrew. And lo and behold, the phone went and it was Andrew.
Yeah, I think quietly confident, kind of really happy that she qualified this year. I think it's a great achievement, and looking forward for her defending the title. I think she's in a good place.
Yeah. I mean, how big a deal was that for her last year, do you think? Because, I mean, as you said, she's qualified again and she's been doing that consistently for years now. And that in itself is an achievement, but to actually win the thing is a significant step again, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that was a big step in her career. Obviously, you beat five top eight players in 1 week. That's an amazing achievement, and saying unique that you won't do any of a tournament of the year because you don't get the opportunity, firstly, but to kind of win so many important matches and make that breakthrough at one of the most important tournaments of the year was amazing.
What do you put that down to, Andrew? Because I mean, she came into the event last year actually not on that great a run, and yet she suddenly produced that run of matches. Did you see that coming? Did you sense it at the time?
No, I'd be lying if I said I sensed it. I think everything kind of clicked at the right time. She was probably playing under quite a bit of pressure the last couple of months of last year because she was working so hard to try and qualify. Then actually into the last week, it was out of her hands. She wasn't playing. The other two players were playing. They didn't qualify. So maybe the pressure kind of just all left and she went out there and was kind of a bit relaxed, playing with nothing to lose so much, and everything clicked and she played great tennis.
Quite an interesting turn of phrase as well, to be playing without pressure, because I mean, every player as a human being will react differently, but I've seen a lot of Alina's matches, I've seen a lot of your coaching on court exchanges, and I wondered what you feel is the main part of your job in order to get her in that mind space where she is playing free like that.
Yeah, that's never easy, and obviously that's always, as an athlete, that's the ideal kind of state of mind you'll be in, but circumstances mean that it's very rarely like that. So I try and relax her, try and get her to play free, to play aggressive, but at the same time do things that she does well, which is fight, be consistent, make a lot of balls, play a high intensity. So playing to her strengths, and then also at the same time, you know, adding a little bit more aggression into the game.
And she took that into this year, didn't she? I mean, did you feel that acted as a springboard because she's ended up reaching new ground at the Grand Slams this year?
Yeah, it's been good. I think she's had the confidence from last year and the biggest stage that she can do it. It's been a kind of a tricky year for her because she's been managing an injury a little bit. But she has made back-to-back semis at Wimbledon and US, which has been fantastic.
How's the injury now?
Yeah, it's better. Like, the hard courts is always difficult. It's tough on the knees, but she's moving great in practice and has been pretty much pain-free as far as I can see.
That's good. Yeah, I saw she was wearing the knee brace at the last tournament that I covered, but that's good to hear. I just wondered, people will have seen you now for a few years courtside with Alina. I remember when Nigel Sears was coaching Anna Ivanovic, you were part of that team as a hitting partner there. Some people are probably wondering, how do you become a coach and particularly get to be a coach of somebody who's a top player like Alina Svitolina? How did this journey happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of probably a situation, right place at the right time. But also maybe I took my opportunity and proved that I had the ability to be a good coach. Like you said, Nigel Sears gave me an opportunity with Anna as a hitting partner We did that together for a year, and then Alina asked me to do the same thing, and then that quickly changed into assistant coach. So I did lots of weeks on my own with her, and I think they went well, and so she gave me more responsibility. And as time kind of progressed, kind of spent 18 months to 2 years in that role. So I probably knew her at that point better than anyone else, kind of what made her tick as a player. And we got on well off the court, which probably helps the on-court relationship as well. So that was good. And she gave me the responsibility, and I hope I've kind of returned the favour with another good year for her this year.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems to be going well. And she starts against Karolina Pliskova. She's in a group with also Bianca Andreescu and Simona Halep. I just wondered, when you come into these matches, I mean, they're all very different players. How detailed do you go when it comes to strategizing these sort of matches?
Yeah, I think it's a balance, because obviously you want your player to play her own game and focus on that, but there's no point ignoring there's a very different game styles in each match. And that's the thing I think I like most about this tournament, is that Alina's played all those players this year. We know them all very well. So I think you can be quite specific in kind of small details, in kind of things you should do, things you should be trying to do throughout the match. And you can probably go into a bit more detail because you have a bit more time to prepare. And now we know who she's playing, so I can kind of look into a bit more stats, look at some old footage of their matches, and where in other tournaments you probably get less than 24 hours to prepare.
Do you tend to give it to her in sort of a handful of bullet points? Is that the way you go?
Yeah, I don't want to overload her with information. She knows every match she has to bring, you know, certain things. Regardless of who she's playing, and then kind of add in a few kind of things that the opponent's going to try and do, and things that Alina can do to play the match on her own terms.
A couple of final points. So I mentioned Karolina Pliskova as the first one. She lost the first five matches she played against her, then she won the next three. So it's 5-3, but she's turned that rivalry, that head-to-head around. What do you put that down to?
I think in general, Alina's kind of over the last couple of years improved at playing big hitters. That was always something, especially when I started working with her 3 years ago, that she wasn't so fond of, playing the big hitters, people who could blast off the court. And we worked really hard on that, kind of adjusting her game a bit to try and take control and not let them dictate as much. I think it's kind of putting her out of her comfort zone a bit. We all know she can run and make 30 balls in a row, but it's difficult to, you know, hit one, two, three shots with real quality, try and take time away from the opponent. So, yeah, it's kind of, we practice a lot on it, big serving, me kind of hitting big ground strokes from ball feeding as well, hitting big and kind of just adjusting her game slightly so she could be more comfortable playing those big big hitters.
Excellent. And Karolina was saying that the court speed is pretty slow. Is that your sense?
Yeah, kind of same as Singapore was as well, pretty slow surface. So kind of hopefully we'll see Alina and we'll expect some long rallies.
Excellent. Well, Andrew, wish you the very best of luck. Thanks ever so much for your time.
Perfect. Thanks a lot, David.
So, Andrew Bettles, lovely to have him with us. And thanks to the WTA communication staff for setting that up for us. Matt, he's an impressive young man, isn't he? And he is a young man. He's done it incrementally. I remember when he started working alongside Nigel Sears, Nigel told me he'd met this, or he knew this young lad who he was going to bring on board with Anna Ivanovic as a hitting partner, and that lasted for about a year before Ivanovic decided to eventually retire. And he always came across well then, and he particularly comes across well in these on-court coaching episodes with Svitolina.
Yeah, he really does, and I really liked what he was saying about the way Svitolina's game has transformed against some of the bigger hitters, because there's a lot of them on the WTA tour, and that really was something that Svitolina used to struggle with. But in these last two or three years, you spoke about how she's turned her head-to-head record against Pliskova around, who obviously she plays tomorrow, so it'll be interesting to see whether she can keep that going. And yeah, he just seems like a really good influence on Svitolina, part of Svitolina's year, I think, has been getting comfortable off court, and that kind of translates onto on court. But yeah, Dave, I just wanted to say for most people, the clocks going back are a really good experience. It's an extra hour in bed, but you've somehow managed to turn it into a mass panic this morning.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Catherine seems absolutely overjoyed about the fact that they went back an hour, because that means an hour of extra sleep.
Exactly.
Which was particularly useful on this occasion, because Catherine was at a Halloween party in a very elaborate fancy dress get-up, and she actually won the prize, didn't she, Matt?
Yeah.
The best costume.
The winning costume, yes. Although she said that she mainly won, well, part of the reason was that she misjudged how costume-centric the party was going to be. I really hope she wasn't the only one in costume, because I feel like...
I kind of do hope.
I feel like that's like turning up to school in your own clothes when it's not an own clothes day. I remember someone doing that at my school and just never living it down.
What did she come as again?
She was Princess Buttercup from Princess Bride.
Right.
The film.
And if you'd like to see a picture of that, go to our Instagram page, and it's there in all its glory. And Catherine will be back tomorrow to tell us all about it.
And she really nailed it as a look. It was, we drew up the sort of side by side with her costume versus the real thing, and yeah, it was spot on.
Right. Very good. Okay.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, there are other matches going on at the moment. I should say Svitolina against Pliskova is the match tomorrow, as we were talking about with Andrew there. The other match of the day is Bianca Andreescu against Simona Halep. It's going to be fascinating, isn't it? Matches start at 10:30 local time, I think, tomorrow. Yes, they do. Well, there's a doubles match first. I say local time, I mean British time. 6:30 local time in the evening it is tomorrow in China, in Shenzhen. And it's Pliskova against Svitolina, followed by Andreescu against Simona Halep. So we'll look forward to that. I'll be getting a chance to commentate on that on BT Sports. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And we will bring you a tennis podcast with Catherine straight afterwards. And in that podcast, we'll also talk about the result of Roger Federer against Alex de Minaur, which is going on at the moment. Federer has a set point. I mean, the ovation he got. I mean, it's no great surprise that he would get a big ovation in Basel. He's trying for his 10th title, isn't he?
Yeah, so I think he's trying to become the first man to win 10 titles on two different surfaces, because he's already won 10 on grass in in Halle, and now he's trying to get 10 indoors in Basel. It's just absurd, really. He seems to...
What a great stat.
He does kind of seem to win those events just every year, so I suppose it's natural that he's gonna get to 10. But I must say I found his introduction quite amusing. Did you hear what they said? They said He's the world number three, but he's our world number one, Roger Federer. It's sort of that's not quite how it works, I don't think.
We're ignoring the facts. Yeah. Here's Roger Federer.
Yeah.
So anyway, I should say as well, he's playing Alex de Minaur, and it takes me back, this does, Matt, because the second final that Federer reached out of his 157 finals was in Basel in 2000, and I was there. And in the semis, he beat, for the very first time in his career, Leighton Hewitt.
Oh, wow.
And it is like 19 years on, Leighton Hewitt's just sent a member of his family, like his nephew, out to go and get revenge for him or something. Because, I mean, for the first few years, Hewitt completely dominated that rivalry. He's beaten him 9 times in total. I think it's 18-9 in favour of Federer. Eventually just got his measure and turned it around. But that particular semi-final, Federer won 6-4, 5-7, 7-6, and it was an 8-6 third set tiebreak. And it was just electric. And that was before Federer was really Federer. He'd not beaten Pete Sampras yet. He hadn't won any Grand Slams yet, but he was full of promise, you know, and you're just waiting for him to burst out and prove it. But in this particular semi-final, Hewitt, who was, you know, on his way to becoming world number one himself at that time, was public enemy number one in front of the crowd and giving them a load back. And eventually Federer, I think he had match point against him in that tiebreak, and he framed a backhand that hit the line.
Oh.
So he got a bit lucky, and then he produced a couple of awesome points to win the match. And I remember him saying to me afterwards, what Hewitt does is he puts so much pressure on your sort of the insides of your thighs because of the movement. The side-to-side movement is like nothing else he'd faced before. That's how quick Hewitt was. And that's what de Minaur, you can see him trying to move him around at the moment. It's not working very well because Federer's just having his way. But it is so interesting to watch that sort of story arc of Federer's career when he was such a young guy. He was a teenager at that point. And we still didn't know then whether he would ever make it at the highest level, whether the potential would ever be realised. And here we are 20 Grand Slam titles later.
Yeah, I always find that fascinating because I was in my tennis watching lifespan, Federer has always been Federer as we know him now, you know, all-time great. So I always think that early period of Federer's career, looking back on it now, must be so fascinating for you in particular, you know, knowing him as you did at the time a little bit and knowing what he's become. Yeah, and it's interesting because de Minaur is a bit of a mini-me in terms of Hewitt, in terms of game style, but he's certainly not that public enemy number one that you were saying Hewitt was. He sort
no.
of...
I mean, Hewitt was...
He's so nice, de Minaur.
Seemed to relish it. The more on his opponent's side the crowd got, the more Hewitt liked it. He was kind of... there was a little bit of Medvedev about him in that way. He was taking everybody on, but Federer got the better of him in that day and then ended up losing to Thomas Enqvist in the final. I remember it was 2 tie breaks. He didn't quite have enough left in the tank. It was just another step, you know, it was just one of those steps to what he would end up becoming. But even back then, you know, 20 years ago, the crowd were convinced in Basel. He was their man, and he hadn't even won the title at that point. So there we are.
It took him a while to win in Basel. I think I was reading his first title was 06, which if you think about it, he'd been a Wimbledon champion for, what, 3 years by then? But he always seems to reach the final. And his level this week has been so high. I think it's the best tennis he's played since Wimbledon, for sure.
The other one is in...
schooled Tsitsipas.
He did. Yeah. Oh, crikey. Yeah, I saw that yesterday. I mean, that was... Tsitsipas, do you think Tsitsipas sometimes can struggle a little bit indoors against guys like him? They can take his time away, can't they?
He doesn't have that blocked return yet that I think he probably needs to develop. And yeah, Federer just was all over him yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's Basel. We'll let you know. Well, we'll recap the result. You can go and look the result up yourself. But we'll recap it in tomorrow's podcast there with Catherine. And in Vienna at the moment, we've got Dominic Thiem in his home tournament trying to stay alive against Diego Schwartzman. You were taken by the reaction to Thiem yesterday. We were talking about Basel and about how happy they were about Roger Federer and being one of their own. And Thiem really feels like he's embraced being hometown hero this week.
Yeah, I've just switched it on now as he's got to set point against Schwartzman, and the standing ovation just to be able to get to set point. He really gets a lot of love there. I couldn't believe that this was his 10th year playing the tournament. It seems amazing to me that he's been around long enough to be able to play 10 Viennas. A couple of those, I think he only played the qualifying. But yeah, yesterday was, I think it was Austria's national day, and he came back to beat Berrettini. And it's just really nice because someone like Thiem, in big matches, he's often playing one of the big three, and often they have more of the support. And just to see him really step up in his home tournament and get such love is just really cool to see, I think, for because he is such a good player, and he's a much better player on hard courts than he was even 18 months ago. He really has made strides, and he's just leveled this match against Schwartzman. But yesterday against Berrettini, I was struck by just how much smarter he was than he used to be, because Berrettini was really beating him, but Thiem figured out that he had to find Berrettini's backhand, which he just wasn't doing, and he figured out ways to be able to do it and really turn the match around. And I just think a year, 2 years ago, he wouldn't have done that. He'd have started blasting the ball and trying to just hit winners, but that wasn't working. He had to figure it out, and he did. And I think Nicolas Massou probably gets a lot of the credit for that, because it's a noticeable impact on Thiem's game this season.
Do we know what that means for Berrettini and the ATP finals? Does that put him out of contention, do you know?
No, he's still in contention. I think Zverev, remarkably...
Paris to come, isn't there?
So Zverev lost first round, but I don't think lost any ground in the race to London. It's kind of still Berrettini, Bautista Agut and Monfils are right on Zverev's heels, and two of those will get in.
And as things stand, everybody's playing Paris, aren't they? I mean, when was the last time that everybody played Paris?
Yeah, it would be remarkable if that did happen. I think the only question mark is probably Federer at this stage. If he wins Basel, he might think, I don't need it. But Nadal's there. He's been practicing with Djokovic, which is a bit rare, I think, for two of those three to be practicing with each other. So, they're all there, and normally that throws up a bit of a surprise champion. I suppose it might still, but with Nadal and Djokovic in the draw, they'll obviously be the favourites.
Yeah, yeah.
Apart from Medvedev.
Yes, oh, obviously. He wins everything. He doesn't lose. Him and Andreescu. Former mixed doubles partnership. Nobody beat them. Anyway, another couple of results of note. Joe Salisbury and Rajiv Ram won the doubles in Vienna. So Salisbury and Ram are in the ATP finals. Salisbury is the sole British player who's going to be at the ATP finals this year, which I don't think we'd have been expecting that at the start of the year, as Roger Federer breaks for two love and leading by a set to love.
Salisbury also...
But it's a nice story.
He also hit the best shot ever today.
Did he? What, describe?
I know those are big words, but the more I think about it, the more I think I've never seen a better shot in my life. He was lobbed, and he was literally not in the picture. He wasn't on screen, and suddenly he hit a tweener, which you only found out it was a tweener on the replay because you couldn't see him hit it, cross court for a clean winner at an obscene amount of pace on it as well. And everyone just sort of thought, how in the world have you done that, Joe Salisbury, including Joe Salisbury?
Ah, fantastic. So well done to him. We have Roger and Takao have won the Basel doubles final against Riley Opelka and Taylor Fritz. Opelka, actually, I think didn't he get to the semis as well? Or the quarters? I can't remember in Basel, but he had a good run. Zuhai Arina Sabalenka has won the title, beating Kiki Bertens. So once again, Sabalenka finishes the year fantastically well, and maybe next year is the one where she breaks through and goes all the way to the WTA finals herself. It's certainly been a good run for her. And anything else, Matt, before we head off?
Well, yeah, just on Sabalenka. So she's there in the doubles, isn't she, in Shenzhen with Mertens? But in her singles this year, Tamini Karrior pointed out that she's 17-2 in China and 23-20 everywhere else. Those are her win-loss records. So, because she won the tour event in Shenzhen at the start of the year, and now has won Wuhan and Zhuhai. But it was just a bit in between where you were kind of left wondering what was going on. But she said that she thinks it's been an important year because last year she didn't really understand what she was doing on the court. She almost didn't understand how she was winning. She was just playing tennis. Whereas her struggles in the middle part of this year, she started to think about her game a little bit more and know what works and what doesn't. And therefore she feels like she can go on the court with a bit more confidence. Whether she can carry this into next year, who knows, but it's certainly pleasing that her ranking hasn't sort of plummeted massively, which was a possibility if she didn't have a good Asian swing. So she'll be right there again next year, and hopefully can have a more consistently strong season throughout.
Okay, well, you know how we were talking about treeing yesterday? Roger Federer, by our Urban Dictionary definition, is officially treeing. He's just hit a forehand half volley passing shot off his toes on the baseline.
Oh wow.
And he's just gone three love ahead and a set ahead. I mean, they've been playing for 45 minutes. It's just absurd. It's the 38-year-old playing against what, 20-year-old?
It's remarkable that Federer's highest level at 38 is still pretty much the highest, sort of certainly,
yeah,
there or thereabouts, and the fact that he's able
certainly the most spectacular,
and the fact that he's able to find that highest level, okay, maybe less regularly than he did 10 years ago, but he's still finding it pretty regularly.
This is like an exhibition, I'm afraid. I mean, I feel sorry for Dimonor. There's nothing he can do about it. Anyway, so we'll look back on the last two games of it tomorrow when Catherine and I get together for another edition of the Tennis Podcast. Matt, thank you for your company as always.
Thank you, David.
And we will be back with more, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by TennisBalls.com. Our mascot is Rio with a Y. Don't forget, you can still get that 15% off code for tickets for the Davis Cup by Rakuten finals, which take place between the 18th and the 24th of November. If you go to DavisCupFinals.com and put in the code TTP Davis Cup Finals, you can get 15% off your tickets. Hope you've enjoyed this one. We'll be back with another tomorrow after the second day of the WTA Finals.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.